to. A follow-up story revealed that the two men were new to the area, were unknown in the gay community, and had no apparent ties to any business, any family, or anything else in the state. Graphic condemnations were offered by those who could be expected to say such things. A local state senator explained that these matters were governed by state laws, and said laws were not about to be changed, not while he was running the legislature. Meyerchek and Spano were unavailable for comment. Their lawyer said they traveled extensively on business. In truth, they were back in Chicago, where one worked as an interior designer and the other owned a bar. They would retain their legal residence in Mississippi and return only when their lawsuit required it. Jackson was then rocked by another brutal crime. Three gang members, all armed with assault weapons, invaded a rented duplex occupied by 20 or so illegal immigrants from Mexico. The Mexicans were known to work 18 hours a day, save every dime, then send it all home once a month. Such home invasions were not uncommon in Jackson and other southern cities. In the chaos of the crime, with the Mexicans scrambling about pulling cash from floors and walls and shrieking hysterically in Spanish as the gunman screamed in very plain English, one of the Mexicans produced a pistol and fired some shots, hitting no one. The gunfire was returned, and a frantic scene turned even more horrific. When the shooting stopped, four of the Mexicans were dead, three were injured, and the gang members had retreated into the night. Their haul was estimated at about $800, though the police would never be certain. Barry Reinhart could not claim the event as one of his creations, but he was nonetheless pleased to hear about it. A week later, at a forum sponsored by a law enforcement association, Cleet Coley seized the crime with zeal and hammered away at his usual themes of violence running unchecked and aided by a liberal court that was stifling executions in Mississippi. He pointed at Sheila McCarthy on stage next to Ron Fisk and harshly blamed her for the court's unwillingness to use the death chamber up at Parchman. The crowd loved him. Ron Fisk was not to be outdone. He railed against gangs and drugs and lawlessness, and he criticized the Supreme Court, though in softer language. He then unveiled a five-step plan to streamline capital murder appeals, and his staff handed out the specific proposals as he spoke. It was an impressive showing, and Tony, seated in the rear, was delighted at the performance. By the time Justice McCarthy rose to speak, the crowd was ready to throw stones. She calmly explained the complexities of death penalty appeals and said that a great deal of the court's time was devoted solely to these difficult cases. She stressed the need to be careful and thorough and make sure each defendant's rights were properly guarded. The law knows no greater burden than protecting the legal rights of those society has decided to execute. She reminded the crowd that at least 120 men and women condemned to death row had later been completely exonerated, including two in Mississippi. Some of these people had spent 20 years waiting to die. In the 9 years she had served on the court, she had participated in 48 death penalty cases. Of those, she had voted with the majority 27 times to affirm the convictions, but only after being certain that fair trials had been conducted. In the other cases, she had voted to reverse the convictions and send the cases back for retrials. She did not regret a single vote. She did not consider herself a liberal, a conservative, or a moderate. She was a Supreme Court justice, sworn to fairly review her cases and uphold the law. Yes, she was personally opposed to the death penalty, but she had never substituted her convictions for the laws of the state. When she finished, there was a scattering of light applause, but only of the polite variety. It was difficult not to admire her bluntness and courage. Few, if any, would vote for her, but the lady knew what she was talking about. It was the first time all three candidates had appeared together, and the first time Tony had watched her under pressure.
She will not be a pushover, he reported to Barry Reinhardt. She knows her stuff and sticks to her guns.
Yes, but she's broke, Barry said with a laugh. This is a campaign, and it's all about money.
McCarthy wasn't exactly broke, but her campaign was off to a miserable start. She had no campaign manager, no one to coordinate the 50 things that needed to be done immediately while coordinating 1,000 details for later. She had offered the job to 3 people, the first 2 declined after considering it for 24 hours, the third said yes, then a week later said no. A campaign is a small, frantic business thrown together under great pressure and with the knowledge that it will have a very short life. The full-time staff works brutal hours for low pay. The volunteers are invaluable, but not always dependable. A forceful and decisive campaign manager is crucial. 6 weeks after Fisk's announcement, Justice McCarthy had managed to open a campaign office in Jackson, near her condo, and one in Biloxi, near her home. Both were run by longtime friends, volunteers, who stayed busy recruiting more staff and calling potential donors. There were piles of bumper stickers and yard signs, but the campaign had been unable to secure a decent firm to put together the ads, direct mail, and hopefully television spots. There was a very basic website, but no other internet activity. Sheila had received $320,000 in contributions, all but $30,000 of it coming from trial lawyers. Bobby Neal and the board had promised her, in writing, that the MTA members would donate at least $1 million, and she did not doubt that they would. But making promises was much easier than writing checks. Getting organized was made more difficult by the fact that she had a demanding job that could not simply be ignored. The court's docket was backed up for a mile with cases that should have been decided months earlier. There was the constant strain of never catching up. The appeals would never stop, and lives were in the balance, men and women on death row, children pulled back and forth in messy divorces, horribly injured workers waiting on a final ruling that hopefully would bring relief. Some of her colleagues were professional enough to detach themselves from the real people behind the cases they considered, but Sheila had never been able to. But it was summertime, and the schedule was less taxing. She was taking off Fridays and spending long weekends on the road, visiting her district. She worked hard Monday through Thursday, then became the candidate. She planned to spend the month getting her campaign organized and on track. Her first opponent, Mr. Coley, generally loafed Monday through Friday, resting himself for the rigors of the blackjack table. He gambled only at night and thus had plenty of time to campaign if he wanted to. Generally, he did not. He showed up at a few county fairs and delivered colorful speeches to enthusiastic crowds. If his volunteers from Jackson were in the mood, they would drive down and erect the Faces of the Dead display, and Cleet raised the volume. Every town has a dozen civic clubs, most of which are always looking for speakers. Word spread that candidate Coley could liven up the lunch, and he received an invitation or two each week. Depending on the drive and the severity of his hangover, he would entertain the idea. By late July, his campaign had received $27,000 in donations, more than enough to cover the costs of his leased SUV and his part-time bodyguards. He had also spent $6,000 on brochures. Every politician must have something to hand out. Sheila's second opponent, though, was leading a campaign that ran like a well-tuned engine. Ron Fisk worked hard at his desk on Mondays and Tuesdays, then hit the road with a detailed schedule that left only the tiniest of towns untouched. Using both the Lear 55 and a King Air, he and his traveling staff quickly circled the district. By mid-July, there was an organized committee in each of the 27 counties, and Ron had given at least one speech in all of them. He spoke to civic clubs, volunteer fire departments, library tees, county bar associations, motorcycle clubs, bluegrass festivals, county fairs, and churches, churches, and churches. At least half of his speeches were in pulpits. On July 18th, Josh played his final baseball game of the season, and his father was free to campaign even more. Coach Fisk did not miss a game, though the team fell apart after he announced his candidacy. Most parents agreed that the two were not related. In the rural areas, Ron's message never varied. Because of liberal judges, our values are under attack from those who support gay marriage, gun control, abortion, and unrestricted access to internet pornography. Those judges must be replaced. His first loyalty was to the Bible. Laws made by men came next, but as a Supreme Court justice, he would manage to reconcile both when necessary. He began each speech with a short prayer. In the less rural areas, depending on the audience, he would often move a little from the far right and dwell on the death penalty. Ron found that audiences were captivated by graphic stories of brutal crimes committed by men who were sentenced to die 20 years ago. He worked a couple of these into his routine. But regardless of where he was, the evil liberal judge theme dominated every speech. After 100 or so, Ron himself believed that Sheila McCarthy was a raging leftist who had caused many of the state's social problems. On the money front, with Barry Reinhart quietly pulling the strings, contributions were arriving at a steady rate and managed to keep pace with expenses. By June 30th, the first deadline to file financial reports, the Fisk campaign had received $510,000 from 2,200 people. Of his contributors, only 35 gave the maximum of $5,000, and every one of these was a Mississippi resident. 90% of donors were from within the state. Barry knew the trial lawyers would scrutinize the contributors in the hope that out-of-state money was pouring in from big business interests. It had been a troublesome campaign issue before, and he would avoid it in the Fisk race. He was confident he would raise huge sums of money from out-of-state, but these donations would pour in at the chosen moment, late in the campaign, when the state's benign reporting laws protected it from being an issue. In contrast, McCarthy's reports revealed that she was being financed by the trial lawyers, and Barry knew precisely how to wield this as an issue in his favor. Barry also had the results of his latest poll, one that he would not share with the candidate. As of June 25th, half the registered voters were now aware that there was a race. Of that number, 24% favored Ron Fisk, 16% Sheila McCarthy, and 10% Cleet Coley. Those numbers were exciting. In less than 2 months, Barry had packaged an unknown lawyer who had never worn a black robe and thrust him ahead of an opponent with 9 years of experience. And they had yet to run a single ad on television. On July 1st, the Second State Bank was purchased by New Vista Bank, a regional chain based in Dallas. Huffy called Wes Payton with the news and was generally upbeat. The Hattiesburg office had been assured that nothing would change but the name. His loan portfolio had been reviewed by the new owners. They had quizzed him about the Paytons and seemed content with Huffy's promises that the loan would eventually be satisfied. For the fourth straight month, the Paytons sent Huffy a check for $2,000. Chapter 22. In another life, Nathaniel Lester had been a flamboyant criminal defense lawyer with an uncanny knack for winning murder trials. At one point, 2 decades earlier, he had put together a streak of 12 consecutive not guilty verdicts, virtually all in small towns throughout Mississippi, the types of places where those accused of heinous crimes are generally presumed guilty the moment they are arrested. His notoriety attracted clients from the civil side, and his country law office in the town of Mendenhall prospered nicely. Nat won big verdicts and negotiated even larger settlements. His specialty became catastrophic personal injuries on the offshore oil rigs where many local men went for high-paying jobs. He was active in various trial lawyer groups, gave huge sums to political candidates, built the biggest house in town, went through a series of wives, and began drinking heavily. The booze, along with a string of ethics complaints and legal skirmishes, finally slowed him down, and when he was ultimately boxed in, he surrendered his law license to avoid a prison sentence. He left Mendenhall, found a new wife, sobered up, and resurfaced in Jackson, where he embraced Buddhism, yoga, vegetarianism, and a simpler lifestyle. One of the few smart decisions he had made during his heyday was to bury some of his money. During the first week of August, he pestered Sheila McCarthy until she agreed to a quick lunch. Every lawyer in the state knew something of his colorful history, and she was understandably nervous. Over tofu and sprouts, he offered to run her campaign at no cost. He would devote his considerable energies to nothing else for the next 3 months. She was apprehensive. His long gray hair fell to his shoulders. He had matching diamond earrings, and though they were quite small, they were still visible. He displayed one tattoo on his left arm, and she didn't want to think of the others and where they might be. He wore jeans and sandals and a collection of bright leather bracelets on each wrist. But Nat had not been a successful courtroom lawyer because he was dull and unpersuasive. He most definitely was not. He knew the district, its towns and courthouses, and the people who ran them. He had a passionate hatred of big business and the influence it bought, and he was bored and looking for a war. She caved in and invited him to join hers. Driving away from the restaurant, she questioned her sanity, but she also had a gut feeling that Nathaniel Lester could be the spark her campaign so badly needed. Her own poll showed her trailing Fisk by 5 points, and a sense of desperation was settling in. They met again that night in her Jackson headquarters, and in a 4-hour meeting, Nat assumed control. With a combination of wit, charm, and castigation, he whipped her ragtag staff into a near frenzy of excitement. To prove his mettle, he called 3 Jackson trial lawyers at home, and after a few pleasantries, asked them why in the hell they had not yet sent money to the McCarthy campaign. Using a speakerphone, he shamed them, cajoled them, berated them, and refused to hang up until each had promised significant contributions from themselves and their families, clients, and friends. "Don't mail the checks," he said. He would personally drive over before noon tomorrow and get the money himself. The 3 commitments totaled $70,000. From that moment, Nat was in charge. The following day, he picked up the checks and began the process of calling every trial lawyer in the state. He contacted labor groups and black leaders. He fired 1 staff member and hired 2 others. By the end of the week, Sheila was getting a morning printout of Nat's version of her daily schedule. She haggled a little, but not much. He was already working 16 hours a day and expected that from the candidate and everyone else. In Hattiesburg, Wes stopped by the home of Judge Harrison for a quiet lunch. With 30 Bowmore cases on his docket, it would be unwise to be seen in public. Though they had no intention of discussing pending business, the coziness would seem inappropriate. Tom Harrison had extended the invitation to Wes and Mary Grace whenever they had the time. Mary Grace was out of town and sent her regrets. The subject was politics. Tom's circuit court district covered Hattiesburg and Forest County and the 3 rural counties of Cary, Lamar, and Perry. Almost 80% of the registered voters were in Hattiesburg, his home and also that of Joy Hoover, his opponent. She would do well in certain precincts in the city, but Judge Harrison was confident he would do even better. Nor was he worried about the smaller counties. In fact, he seemed generally unconcerned about losing. Hoover appeared to be well-financed, probably with outside money, but Judge Harrison knew his district and enjoyed its politics. Cary County had the smallest population of the four, and it was continuing to decline with no small measure of help from Crane Chemical and its toxic history. They avoided that topic and discussed various politicians in and around Bowmore. Wes assured him that the Paytons, as well as their clients, friends, Pastor Denny Ott, and Mary Grace's family, would do everything possible to re-elect Judge Harrison. Conversation shifted to other races, primarily that of Sheila McCarthy. She had passed through Hattiesburg 2 weeks earlier and spent half an hour at the Payton firm, where she awkwardly managed to avoid mentioning the Bowmore litigation while rounding up votes. The Paytons admitted they had no money to contribute, but promised to work overtime to get her reelected. A truckload of yard signs and other campaign materials had been delivered to the office the following day. Judge Harrison lamented the politicization of the Supreme Court. "It's unseemly," he was saying, "how they are forced to grovel for votes. You, as a lawyer representing a client in a pending case, should have no contact whatsoever with a Supreme Court justice. But because of the system, one comes to your office seeking money and support. Why? Because some special interests with plenty of money have decided they would like to own her seat on the court. They're spending money to purchase a seat. She responds by raising money from her side of the street. It's a rotten system, Wes. How do you fix it? Either take away the private money and finance the races with public funds, or switch to appointments. 11 other states have figured out how to make the appointment system work. I'm not sure their courts are vastly superior to ours in terms of legal talent, but at least the special interests don't control them." "Do you know Fisk?" Wes asked. "He's been in my courtroom a couple of times. Nice fella, green as hell. Looks nice in a suit. Typical insurance defense routine. Opens his files, files his motions, settles, closes his files, never gets his hands dirty. He's never heard a case, mediated one, tried one, and he's never shown any interest in being a judge. Think about it, Wes. Every small town needs lawyers occasionally to serve as city judges or assistant magistrates or traffic court referees, and we all felt the obligation to step in when we were younger. Not this guy. Every small county needs lawyers to pinch hit with youth court and drug court and the like, and those of us who aspired to be real judges volunteered. I mean, you gotta start somewhere. Not this guy. I bet he's never been to city court in Brookhaven or youth court in Lincoln County. He wakes up one day, decides he's suddenly passionate about the judiciary, and what the hell, he'll just start at the top. It's an insult to those of us who toil in the system and make it work. I doubt if running was his idea." "No, he was recruited. That makes it even more shameful. They look around, pick some greenhorn with a nice smile and no record to attack, and package him with the slick marketing. That's politics, but it shouldn't contaminate the judiciary. We beat him 2 years ago with McElwain. So you're optimistic?" "No, Judge. I'm terrified. I haven't slept well since Fisk announced, and I won't sleep well until he's defeated. We're broke and in debt, so we can't write a check, but every member of our firm has agreed to spend 1 hour a day knocking on doors, passing out brochures, putting up yard signs, and making phone calls. We've written letters to our clients. We're leaning on our friends. We've organized Bowmore. We're doing everything possible, because if we lose the Baker case, there is no tomorrow. Where is the appeal?" "All the briefs are in. Everything is nice and tidy and waiting on the court to tell us when and if it wants oral argument. Probably early next year." "No chance of a decision before the election?" "None whatsoever. It's the most important case on the docket, but then every lawyer feels this way. As you know, the court works on its own schedule. No one can push it." They had iced coffee as they inspected the judge's small vegetable garden. The temperature was 100 degrees, and Wes was ready to go. They finally shook hands on the front porch. As Wes drove away, he couldn't help but worry about him. Judge Harrison was much more concerned about the McCarthy race than his own. The hearing was on a motion to dismiss filed by Hinds County. The courtroom belonged to Chancellor Phil Shingleton. It was a small, busy, efficient courtroom with oak walls and the obligatory faded portraits of long-forgotten judges. There was no box for the jurors because jury trials did not occur in Chancery Court. Crowds were rare, but for this hearing, every seat was taken. Meyercheck and Spano, back from Chicago, sat with their radical lawyer at one table. At the other were two young women representing the county. Chancellor Shingleton called things to order, welcomed the crowd, noted the interest from the media, and looked at the file. Two courtroom artists worked on Meyercheck and Spano. Everyone waited anxiously as Shingleton flipped through the paperwork as if he had never seen it. In fact, he had read it many times and had already written his ruling.
"Just curious," he said without looking up. "Why did you file this thing in Chancery Court?"
The radical lawyer stood up and said,
"It's a matter of equity, Your Honor, and we knew we could expect a fair trial here."
If it was intended as humor, it missed its mark. The reason it was filed in Chancery Court was to get it dismissed as soon as possible. A hearing in circuit court would take even longer. A federal lawsuit would go off in the wrong direction.
"Proceed," Shingleton said.
The radical lawyer was soon railing against the county and the state and society in general. His words came in short, rapid bursts, much too loud for the small room and much too shrill to listen to for more than 10 minutes. He went on and on. The laws of the state were backward and unfair and discriminated against his clients because they couldn't marry each other. Why shouldn't two mature and consenting gay adults who are in love and want all the responsibilities and obligations and commitments and duties of matrimony be allowed the same privileges and legal rights as two heterosexuals? He managed to ask this question at least 8 different ways. "The reason," explained one of the young ladies for the county, "is that the laws of the state do not permit it. Plain and simple. The state's constitution grants to the legislature the right to make laws regarding marriage, divorce, and so on, and no one else has this authority. If and when the legislature approves same-sex marriage, then Mr. Meyercheck and Mr. Spano will be free to pursue their desires."
"Do you expect the legislature to do this anytime soon?" Shingleton deadpanned.
"No," was the quick reply. And it was good for some light laughter. The radical lawyer rebutted with the strenuous argument that the legislature, especially our legislature, passed laws every year that are struck down by the courts. That is the role of the judiciary. After making this point loud and clear, he devised several ways to present it in slightly different formats. After an hour, Shingleton was fed up. Without a recess and glancing at his notes, he gave a ruling that was rather succinct. His job was to follow the laws of the state, and if the laws of the state prohibited marriage between two men or two women or two men and one woman or whatever combination, anything other than one man and one woman, then he, as a chancellor, had no choice but to dismiss the case. Outside the courthouse, with Meyercheck on one side and Spano on the other, the radical lawyer continued his screeching for the press. He was aggrieved. His clients were aggrieved, though it was noted by a few that both looked quite bored with it all. They were appealing immediately to the Mississippi Supreme Court. That's where they were headed, and that's where they wanted to be. And with the shadowy firm of Troy Hogan paying the bills from Boca Raton, that's exactly where they were going. Chapter 23. During its first 4 months, the race between Sheila McCarthy and Ron Fisk had been markedly civil. Cleet Coley had thrown his share of mud, but his general appearance and unruly personality made it difficult for voters to see him as a Supreme Court justice. Though he still received about 10% in Reinhart's polls, he was campaigning less and less.
Nat Lester's poll gave him 5%, but that poll was not as detailed as Reinhardt's. After Labor Day, with the election 2 months away and the home stretch of the race at hand, Fisk's campaign took its first ugly step toward the gutter. Once on that course, it would not and could not turn back. The tactic was one Barry Reinhardt had perfected in other races. A mass mailing was sent to all registered voters from an outfit called Lawsuit Victims for Truth. It screamed the question, why are the trial lawyers financing Sheila McCarthy? The four-page diatribe that followed did not attempt to answer the question. Instead, it excoriated trial lawyers. First, it used the family doctor, claiming that trial lawyers and the frivolous lawsuits they bring are responsible for many of the problems in our healthcare system. Doctors, laboring under the fear of lawsuit abuse, are forced to perform expensive tests and diagnoses that drive up the cost of medical care. Doctors must pay exorbitant premiums for malpractice insurance to protect themselves from bogus lawsuits. In some states, doctors have been driven out, leaving their patients without care. One doctor, no residence given, was quoted as saying, "I couldn't afford the premiums, and I was tired of spending hours in depositions and trials, so I simply quit. I still worry about my patients." A hospital in West Virginia was forced to close after getting hit with an outrageous verdict. A greedy trial lawyer was at fault. Next, it hit the checkbook. Rampant litigation cost the average household $1,800 a year, according to one study. This expense is a direct result of higher insurance premiums on automobiles and homes, plus higher prices for 1,000 household products whose makers are constantly being sued. Medications, both prescription and over-the-counter, are a perfect example. They would be 15% cheaper if the trial lawyers didn't hammer their manufacturers with massive class action cases. Then it shocked the reader with a collection of some of the country's zaniest verdicts, a well-used and trusted list that always sparked outrage. $3 million against a fast food chain for hot coffee that was spilled. $110 million against a car maker for a defective paint job. $15 million against the owner of a swimming pool that was fenced and padlocked. The infuriating list went on and on. The world is going crazy and being led by devious trial lawyers. After breathing fire for three pages, it finished with a bang. 5 years earlier, Mississippi had been labeled by a pro-business group as a judicial hellhole. Only four other states shared this distinction, and the entire process would have been overlooked but for the Commerce Council. It seized the news and splashed it around in newspaper ads. Now the issue was worthy of being used again. According to the Lawsuit Victims for Truth, the trial lawyers have so abused the court system in Mississippi that the state is now a dumping ground for all sorts of major lawsuits. Some of the plaintiffs live elsewhere. Many of the trial lawyers live elsewhere. They forum shop until they find a friendly county with a friendly judge, and there they file their cases. Huge verdicts are the result. The state has earned a shady reputation, and because of this, many businesses avoid Mississippi. Dozens of factories have packed up and left. Thousands of jobs are gone. All thanks to the trial lawyers, who of course adore Sheila McCarthy and her pro-plaintiff leanings and will spend anything to keep her on the court. The mailing ended with a plea for sanity. It never mentioned Ron Fisk. An email blast then sent the ad to 65,000 addresses in the district. Within hours, it had been picked up by the trial lawyers and sent to all of the MTA's 800 members. Nat Lester was thrilled with the ad. As campaign manager, he preferred broad-based support from many groups, but the reality was that the only major donors to McCarthy were the trial lawyers. He wanted them angry, spitting nails, frothing at the mouth, ready for an old-fashioned bare-knuckle brawl.
So far, they had given just under $600,000. Nat needed twice that, and the only way to get it was by throwing grenades. He sent an email to every trial lawyer, and in it he explained the urgent necessity of answering the propaganda as quickly as possible. Negative ads, both in print and on television, must be responded to immediately. Direct mail is expensive, but very effective. He estimated the cost of the lawsuit victims for truth mailing at $300,000. Actual cost, $320,000. Since he planned to use direct mail more than once, he demanded an immediate infusion of $500,000, and he insisted on commitments by return email. His coded email address would publish a running total of new contributions from trial lawyers, and until it reached the goal of $500,000, the campaign would remain virtually hamstrung. His tactic bordered on extortion, but then he was still, at heart, a trial lawyer, and he knew the breed. The mailing jolted their blood pressure to near lethal levels. They loved to fight anyway, and the commitments would pour in. While he manipulated them, he met with Sheila and tried to calm her. She had never been attacked before in such a manner. She was upset, but also angry. The gloves were off, and Mr. Nathaniel Lester was relishing the fight. Within 2 hours, he had designed and written a response, met with the printer, and ordered the necessary supplies. 24 hours after the lawsuit victims for truth's plea was sent by email, 330 trial lawyers had committed $515,000. Nat also went after the Trial Lawyers of America, several of whose members had made fortunes in Mississippi. He emailed the lawsuit victims for truth's fulmination to 14,000 of its members. 3 days later, Sheila McCarthy counterpunched. Refusing to hide behind some silly group organized just to send propaganda, she, Nat, decided to send the correspondence from her own campaign. It was in the form of a letter, with a flattering photo of her at the top. She thanked each voter for his or her support and quickly ran through her experience and qualifications. She claimed to have nothing but respect for her opponents, but neither had ever worn the black robe. Neither, frankly, had ever shown any interest in the judiciary. Then she posed the question, why is big business financing Ron Fisk? Because, she explained in detail, big business is currently in the business of buying seats on Supreme Courts all over the country. They target justices like herself, compassionate jurists who strive for the common ground and are sympathetic to the rights of workers, consumers, victims injured by the negligence of others, the poor, and the accused. The law's greatest responsibility is to protect the weakest members of our society. Rich people can usually take care of themselves. Big business, through its myriad support groups and associations, is successfully coordinating a grand conspiracy to drastically change our court system. Why? To protect its own interests. How? By blocking the courthouse door. By limiting liability for companies that make defective products, for negligent doctors, for abusive nursing homes, for arrogant insurance companies. The sad list went on. She finished with a folksy paragraph asking the voters not to be fooled by slick marketing. The typical campaign run by big business in these races gets very ugly. Mud is their favorite tool. The attack ads would soon begin, and they would be relentless. Big business would spend millions to defeat her, but she had faith in the voters. Barry Reinhart was impressed with the response. He was also delighted to see the trial lawyers rally so quickly and spend so much money. He wanted them to burn money. The high end of his projection was $2 million for the McCarthy camp, with 90% from the trial lawyers. His boy Fisk could easily double that. His next ad, again by direct mail, was a sucker punch that would quickly dominate the rest of the campaign. He waited a week, Time for the dust to settle from the first exchange of jabs. The letter came straight from Ron Fisk himself, on his campaign letterhead, with a photo at the top of the handsome Fisk family. Its ominous headline announced, Mississippi Supreme Court to rule on gay marriage. After a warm greeting, Ron wasted no time in launching into the issue at hand. The case of Meyercheck and Spano versus Hinds County involved two gay men who wanted to get married, and it would be decided the following year by the Supreme Court. Ron Fisk, Christian, husband, father, lawyer, was adamantly opposed to same-sex marriages, and he would take this unshakable belief to the Supreme Court. He condemned such unions as abnormal, sinful, against the clear teachings of the Bible, and detrimental to society on many levels. Halfway through the letter, he introduced to the fray the well-known voice of the Reverend David Wilfong, a national loudmouth with a huge radio following. Wilfong decried such efforts to pervert our laws and bend yet again to the desires of an immoral few. He denounced liberal judges who insert their own beliefs into their rulings. He called upon the decent and God-fearing people of Mississippi, the heart and soul of the Bible Belt, to embrace men like Ron Fisk and, in doing so, protect their state's sacred laws. The liberal judge theme continued to the end of the letter. Fisk signed off with another promise to serve as a conservative, common-sense voice of the people. Sheila McCarthy read the letter with Nat, and neither knew what the next step should be. Her name was never mentioned, but then it really wasn't necessary. Fisk certainly wasn't accusing Cleet Coley of being a liberal. "This is deadly," Nat said, exasperated. "He has claimed this issue as his own, and to take it back, or even to share it, you have to pulverize homosexuals worse than he does." "I'm not doing that." "I know you're not." "It is so improper for a member of the court, or one who aspires to be, to state how he or she will decide a future case. It's horrible." "This is just the beginning, dear." They were in the cramped storage room that Nat called his office. The door was shut. No one was listening. A dozen volunteers were busy in the adjacent room. Phones rang constantly.
"I'm not sure we answer this," Nat said.
"Why not?"
"What are you going to say? Ron Fisk is being mean? Ron Fisk is saying things he shouldn't? You'll come off looking bitchy, which is okay for a male candidate, but not for a female.
That's not fair."
"The only response is a denial of your support for same-sex marriages. You would have to take a position which..."
"Which I'm not going to do. I'm not in favor of these marriages, but we need some type of civil union arrangement. It's a ridiculous debate, though, because the legislature is in charge of making laws, not the court."
Nat was on his fourth wife. Sheila was looking for husband number two.
"And besides," she said, "how could homosexuals possibly screw up the sanctity of marriage any worse than heterosexuals?"
"Promise me you'll never say that in public. Please."
"You know I won't."
He rubbed his hands together, then ran his fingers through his long gray hair. Indecisiveness was not one of his shortcomings.
"We have to make a decision here and now," he said. "We can't waste time. The smartest route is to answer by direct mail."
"What's the cost?"
"We can scale back some. I'd say $200,000.
"Can we afford it?"
"As of today, I would say no. Let's revisit it in 10 days.
"Agreed. But can't we do an email blast and at least respond?"
"I've already written it."
The response was a two-paragraph message sent that day to 48,000 email addresses. Justice McCarthy issued a strong rebuke to Ron Fisk for pledging his vote on a case he was far away from hearing. Had he been a member of the court, he would have been chastised. Dignity demands that the justices keep matters confidential and refrain from any comment whatsoever about pending cases. In the one he mentioned, no briefs have been filed in the appeal, no arguments heard, nothing was before the court as of this date. Without knowing the facts or the law, how could Mr. Fisk, or anyone else for that matter, possibly decide
on a final ruling. Sadly, it was just another example of Mr. Fisk's woeful inexperience in judicial matters. Cleet Coley's losses were piling up at the Lucky Jack, and he confided this to Marlin late one night in a saloon in Under the Hill. Marlin was passing through, checking on the candidate, who seemed to have forgotten about the race.
"I have a great idea," Marlin said, warming up to the real reason for his visit.
"There are 14 casinos on the Gulf Coast, big, beautiful Vegas style. I've seen them."
"Right.
I know the guy who owns Pirate's Cove. He'll put you up 3 nights a week for the next month. Penthouse suite, great view of the Gulf. Meals are on the house. You can play cards all night, and during the day, you can do a bit of campaigning. Folks down there need to hear your message. Hell, that's where the votes are. I can line up some audiences. You do the politicking. You've got a great speech, and people love it."
Cleet was visibly taken with the idea.
"3 nights a week, huh? More if you want it. You gotta be tired of this place."
"Only when I'm losing."
"Do it, Cleet. Look, the folks who put up the money would like to see more activity. They know it's a long shot, but they are serious about their message."
Cleet admitted it was a great idea. He ordered more rum and began thinking of those beautiful new casinos down there. Chapter 24. Mary Grayson West stepped off the elevator on the 26th floor of the tallest building in Mississippi and into the plush reception suite of the state's largest law firm. She immediately noticed the wallpaper, the fine furniture, the flowers, things that had once mattered. The well-dressed woman at the desk was sufficiently polite. An associate in the standard-issue navy suit and black shoes escorted them to a conference room, where a secretary asked if they wanted something to drink. No, they did not. The large windows looked down at the rest of Jackson. The dome of the Capitol dominated the view. To its left was the Garten Building, and somewhere in there on someone's desk was the case of Jeanette Baker versus Crane Chemical. The door opened and Alan York appeared with a big smile and warm handshake. He was in his late 50s, short and heavy, and a bit sloppy. Wrinkled shirt, no jacket, scuffed shoes, unusual for a partner in such a hidebound firm. The same associate was back, carrying 2 large expandable files. After greetings and small talk, they took their places around the table. The lawsuit the Paytons filed in April on behalf of the family of the deceased pulpwood cutter had sped through the early rounds of discovery. No trial date was set, and that possibility was at least a year away. Liability was clear. The truck driver who caused the accident had been speeding at least 15 miles per hour over the limit. 2 eyewitnesses had been deposed and provided detailed and damning testimony about the speed and recklessness of the truck driver. In his deposition, the driver admitted to a long history of moving violations. Before taking to the road, he worked as a pipe fitter, but had been fired for smoking pot on the job. Wes had found at least 2 old DUIs, and the driver thought there might be another one, but he couldn't remember. In short, the case wouldn't get anywhere near a jury. It would be settled, and after 4 months of vigorous discovery, Mr. Alan York was ready to begin the negotiations. According to him, his client, Lytton Casualty, was anxious to close the file. Wes began by describing the family, a 33-year-old widow and mother with a high school education and no real job skills, and 3 young children, the oldest being 12. Needless to say, the loss was ruinous in every way. As he talked, York took notes and kept glancing at Mary Grace. They had spoken on the phone but never met. Wes was handling the case, but York knew she was not there simply because she was pleasant to look at. One of his close friends was Frank Sully, the Hattiesburg lawyer hired by Crane Chemical to add bodies to the defense table. Sully had been pushed to the rear by Jared Curtin and was still bitter about it. He had passed along to York many stories about the Baker trial, and it was Sully's opinion that the Peyton tag team worked best when Mary Grace was chatting with the jury. She was tough on cross-examination, very quick on her feet, but her strength was connecting with people. Her closing argument was brilliant, powerful, and obviously very persuasive. York had been defending insurance companies for 31 years. He won more than he lost, but there had been a few of those awful moments when juries failed to see the case his way and nailed him for big verdicts. It was part of the business. He had never, though, been in the neighborhood of a $41 million award. It was now a legend in the state's legal circles. Add the drama of the Peytons risking everything, losing their home, office, cars, and borrowing heavily to sustain a 4-month trial, and the legend kept growing. Their fate was well known and much discussed at bar meetings and golf tournaments and cocktail parties. If the verdict stood, they would be primed to rake in huge fees. A reversal, and their survival was seriously in doubt. As Wes went on, York couldn't help but admire them. After a brief review of the liability, Wes summed up the damages, added a chunk for the carelessness of the trucking company, and said, "We think $2 million is a fair settlement."
"I bet you do,"
York said, managing the customary defense lawyer reaction of shock and dismay, eyebrows arched in disbelief, head shaking slowly in bewilderment. He grabbed his face with his hand and squeezed his cheeks, frowning. His quick smile was long gone. Wes and Mary Grace managed to convey apathy while their hearts were frozen. "To get $2 million," York said, studying his notes, "you have to factor in some element of punitive damages, and frankly, my client is simply not willing to pay these."
"Oh, yes," Mary Grace said coolly. "Your client will pay whatever the jury tells it to pay."
Such blustering was also part of the business. York had heard it 1,000 times, but it did indeed sound more ominous coming from a woman who, during her last trial, extracted a huge punitive award.
"A trial is at least 12 months away," York said as he looked at his associate for confirmation,
as if anyone could project a trial date so far in the future. The associate dutifully confirmed what his boss had already said. "In other words, if this goes to trial, it will be months before you receive a dime in fees. It's no secret that your little firm is drowning in debt and struggling to survive, and everyone knows that you need a big settlement and quick."
"Your client can't wait that long," York said.
"We've given you a number, Alan," Wes replied. "Do you have a counteroffer?" York suddenly slapped his file shut and gave a forced grin and said,
"Look, this is really simple. Litton Casualty is very good at cutting its losses, and this case is a loser. My authority to settle is $1 million, not a penny more. I have $1 million, and my client told me not to come back for more. $1 million, take it or leave it."
The referring lawyer would get half of the 30% contingency contract. The Peytons would get the other half. 15% was $150,000, a dream. They looked at each other, both frowning, both wanting to leap across the table and begin kissing Alan York. Then Wes shook his head and Mary Grace wrote something on a legal pad.
"We have to call our client," Wes said.
"Of course,"
York bolted from the room, his associate racing to keep up.
"Well," Wes said softly, as if the room might be bugged.
"I'm trying not to cry," she said.
"Don't cry, don't laugh. Let's squeeze him a little."
When York was back, Wes said gravely, "We talked to Mrs. Nolan. Her bottom line is $1.2 million. York exhaled as his shoulders drooped and his face sagged.
"I don't have it, Wes," he said. "I'm being perfectly candid with you.
You can always ask for more. If your client will pay $1 million, then he can kick in another $200,000. At trial, this case is worth twice that."
"Litton is a tough bunch, Wes."
"One phone call. Give it a try. What's there to lose?"
York left again, and 10 minutes later burst back into the room with a happy face.
"You got it. Congratulations."
The shock of the settlement left them numb. Negotiations usually dragged on for weeks or months, with both sides bickering and posturing and playing little games. They had hoped to leave York's office with a general idea of where the settlement might be headed. Instead, they left in a daze and for 15 minutes roamed the streets of downtown Jackson, saying little. For a moment, they stopped in front of the Capitol Grill, a restaurant known more for its clientele than for its food. Lobbyists like to be seen there, picking up tabs for fine meals with heavyweight politicians. Governors had always favored the place. Why not splurge and eat with the big boys? Instead, they ducked into a small deli two doors down and ordered iced tea. Neither had an appetite at the moment. Wes finally addressed the obvious. Did we just earn $180,000?
Uh-huh, she said while sipping tea through a straw.
I thought so.
A third goes for taxes, she said. Are you trying to kill the party?
No, just being practical. On a white paper napkin, she wrote down the sum of $180,000.
Are we spending it already? Wes asked.
No, we're dividing it.
$60,000 for taxes?
$50,000.
Income, state and federal, employee withholding, Social Security, unemployment.
I don't know what else, but it's at least a third.
55, he said, and she wrote down $60,000.
Bonuses?
What about a new car, he asked.
Nope. Bonuses for all five employees. They have not had a raise in 3 years.
$5,000 each. She wrote down $25,000, then said,
the bank, a new car.
The bank? Half the fee is already gone.
$200.
Come on, Wes. We won't have a life until the bank is off our backs.
I've tried to forget about the loan.
How much?
I don't know. I'm sure you have a figure.
$50,000 for Huffy and $10,000 for Sheila McCarthy. That leaves us with $35,000,
which at that moment seemed like a fortune. They stared at the napkin, both recasting the numbers and rearranging the priorities, but neither willing to suggest a change. Mary Grace signed her name at the bottom, then Wes did likewise. She put the napkin in her purse.
Can I at least get a new suit out of the deal? He asked.
Depends on what's on sale. I guess we should call the office.
They're sitting by the phone.
3 hours later, the Paytons walked into their office, and the party started. The front door was locked, the phones were unplugged, the champagne began to flow. Sherman and Rusty, the law clerks, proposed lengthy toasts they had hurriedly put together. Tabby and Vicky, the receptionists, were tipsy after two glasses. Even Olivia, the ancient bookkeeper, kicked up her heels and was soon laughing at everything. The money was spent, respent, overspent, until everyone was rich. When the champagne was gone, the office closed and everyone left. The Paytons, their cheeks warm from the bubbly, went to their apartment, changed into casual clothes, then drove to the school to fetch Mac and Liza. They had earned a night of fun, though the children were too young to understand the settlement. It would never be mentioned. Mac and Liza were expecting Ramona, and when they saw both parents in the school pickup line, a long day instantly became brighter. Wes explained that they simply got tired of working and decided to play. The first stop was Baskin-Robbins for ice cream. Next, they went to a shopping mall where a shoe store attracted their attention. Each Payton picked out a pair at 50% off, with Mac being the boldest with a pair of marine combat boots. In the center of the mall was a four-screen cinema. They caught the 6 p.m. showing of the latest Harry Potter. Dinner was a family pizzeria with an indoor playground and a rowdy atmosphere. They finally made it home around 10, where Ramona was watching television and enjoying the quiet. The kids handed her leftover pizza and both talked at once about the movie. They promised to finish their homework in the morning. Mary Grace relented, and the entire family settled onto the sofa and watched a reality rescue show. Bedtime was pushed back to 11. When the apartment was quiet and the kids tucked in, Wes and Mary Grace lay on the sofa, heads on opposite ends, legs tangled together,
minds drifting far away. For the past 4 years, as their finances had spiraled downward, with one loss after another, one humiliation following the last, fear had become a daily companion. Fear of losing the home, then the office, then the autos, fear of not being able to provide for their children, fear of a serious medical emergency that exceeded their insurance, fear of losing the Baker trial, fear of bankruptcy if the bank pushed too hard. Since the verdict, the fear had become more of a nuisance than a constant threat. It was always there, but they had slowly gained control of it. For 6 straight months now, they had paid the bank $2,000 a month, hard-earned monies that were left over after all the other bills and expenses. It barely covered the interest, and it reminded them of how insurmountable their debt was. But it was symbolic. They were digging out from the rubble and could see the light. Now, for the first time in years, there was a cushion, a safety net, something to catch them if they fell even deeper. They would take their share of today's settlement and hide it, and when they were afraid again, they would be comforted by their buried treasure. At 10 the following morning, Wes dropped by the bank and found Huffy at his desk. He swore him to silence, then whispered the good news. Huffy almost hugged him. Mr. Prickhead was on his back from 9 to 5, demanding action. "The money should be here in a couple of weeks," Wes said proudly. "I'll call as soon as it lands."
$50,000, Wes?"
Huffy repeated, as if his job had just been saved. "You got it." From there, Wes drove to his office. Tabby handed him a phone message from Alan York, just routine stuff, probably some details to nail down. But York's voice lacked its usual warmth.
"Wes, there's a new wrinkle," he said slowly, as if searching for words.
"What's the matter?" Wes asked. A knot was already forming in his stomach.
"I don't know, Wes. I'm really frustrated and confused. This has never happened to me. But, well, anyway, Litton Casualty has flipped on the settlement. It's off the table. All of it. They're yanking it. Some tough a-holes. I've been yelling at them all morning. They yell back. This firm has represented the company for 18 years, never had a problem like this. But as of 1 hour ago, they are looking for another firm. I've fired the client. I gave you my word, and now my client has hung me out to dry. I'm sorry, Wes. Don't know what else to say."
Wes pinched the bridge of his nose and tried not to groan.